Hi, it's Greg here. Due to the fact that I'm travelling to Sacramento to attend the HP Network Tech Day next week, and Ethan and Dan have other commitments, we've recorded a bumper double show this week to be released in two parts. This is part one of Big, Hot and Heavy Switches, and part two will be released next weekend. Ivan Pepelniak and myself have joined together for a Meet the Author event in San Jose on September 15th. Ivan, of course, is the well-known blogger at ioshints.info and is the author of many Cisco Press textbooks and well-known and respected in the industry for his deep technical knowledge. And I'll be there to provide advice on server and storage networking and with my unique critical viewpoint on vendor technologies. With a strictly limited number of seats, we will be meeting you in an open room format to discuss data center networking design and implementation in a small group. You can bring your designs, questions and topics for us to discuss, analyze, whiteboard, and to provide feedback in our three-hour session. You can find more information at ioshintsdatacenter.eventbrite.com. And that URL is in the show notes. It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready? Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and various ideas and then get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the network world with humour, wit and maybe even some technical talent. And speaking of talent, our world-class pool of resources are here again this week to do the business. Let's introduce the show people on the show today. First of all, I'd like to welcome my very good new friend, Ivan Pepelniak. How are you, Ivan?
Pretty good. Thank you, Greg.
Hey, welcome to the show once again. I know you were on several weeks ago, and it's good to have you back. What have you been doing with yourself?
Well, I'm bored of PowerPoint this week. I'm preparing the material for my new webinar. And it's so many pictures, I'm barely waiting for it to be finished.
That's your new data center webinar?
Oh, yeah.
And people can find out about that on your website?
Exactly. It's ioshints.info or blog.ioshints.info.
And you can find Ivan on his Twitter handle at ioshints. And also on the show this week, we've got Jeremy Philibin. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate the return invitation.
Oh, pleasure to have you. What have you been doing with yourself this week?
This week has been a couple blog posts on my blog, jeremyphilibin.com, and preparing to build a new data center for my employer.
A whole data center? Are you doing the bricks as well, or are you just doing the design?
Actually, it's a managed data center, but I'm responsible for the network. So, you know, build is always relative in our field.
And also on the show this week is Steve Rossen. Hello, Steve. How you doing?
Hey, Greg. Doing well. It's an honor to be on the show this week.
Thanks very much for making it. Of course, you are at Steve on Twitter, possibly the most misguided Twitter handle ever.
Yeah, it's a unique name. Of course, I get all the messages when people say at Steve Space Jobs on an Apple event. But other than that, I enjoy it.
It'd be unique. I bet you've got a lot more followers than I have.
I do get some random ones.
Okay. And also with us this week, we have Ethan Banks. What have you been doing this week, Ethan?
Hey, I continue to build out my network stuff, replacing some old stuff with new stuff and so on. Really old stuff with really new stuff. Like I pulled out this 7200 out of the rack this week and looked at the manufacture data. It was 2000, and I had put in a shiny new 3900 series that had been manufactured just a couple of weeks ago. Kind of nice and comfortable to be doing those sorts of things. A lot more of that to come in my future.
Outstanding. Pleased to hear it. Okay, well, this week we've decided to put together a show which is focused on the data center. Well, maybe what we should call it is the Big Hairy Switch Show, because really what we wanted to do is take a look at Cisco switches, which are mostly used in the data centers, and then run an end run around a whole bunch of topics that we've got listed about it. So brought together some of the best minds in this sort of an area, of course, with Jeremy, Steve, and Ivan. All people are focused on these switches and stuff like that. So the first topic I want to look at this week is the difference between the virtual switching system and the virtual port channel system. VSS, of course, is the technology in the 6500 platform, which uses a tightly coupled supervisor engine where they connect the two switching fabrics of the supervisors into a single element to form two physical switches into one logical switch. A virtual port channel is the technology used in the Cisco Nexus 7000, which uses a more traditional loose-coupled approach where each switch operates as a fully independent autonomous system in the back. And this type of a design means that each switch is an independent processing unit, but when you send packets from one switch to either one, they reassemble them back into the order they wanted to go. So the question is, which is better? Is VSS better or is virtual PC better? Let's kick this discussion off with Ivan. What do you think the difference is between the two, and which one's got advantages and disadvantages?
Well, personally, I prefer VPC because the boxes stay independent. So if one box has a problem, the other box is not affected. Whereas with VSS, you basically turn off all the soups you have in the whole system apart from one. And if that one dies, then another one has to take over.
And that's so a lot harder to design, isn't it? So from a software point of view, it's a lot more difficult to design.
Yeah. I would be really nervous, sort of like putting two core switches into like a stack.
Yeah, well, that's what it is, isn't it? VSS is like a stack technology where it's very similar to the 3750 type stack where each switching engine in the blade is doing the layer 2 packet forwarding, either, you know, sending it onto the backplane, up the stacking module or out the port next to it. But somewhere in the switch is a routing engine which controls the whole nature of the stack. And a VSS works the same way, doesn't it?
Actually, it doesn't. Because all the forwarding is done locally in whichever box is doing the forwarding. It's just the control plane that is common.
So that's the on the supervisor engine, there's three engines, isn't there? There's the routing engine, the policy, the PFC, and the fabric switch. So the fabric switch in the left switch and the right switch connect together over the two in the VSS between the two gigabit lines, don't they? And then only one of the control planes from each of the supervisors is active.
That's my understanding. So the way it was explained to me is that all the switching in both boxes work, but it's just one control plane.
But the policy feature card on each one is active, though, isn't it?
It would have to be. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, none of those features would work on the second box. Because, as Ivan said, the point of it is to keep all the switching local and to use those cross links that connect the two VSS boxes together as little as possible. So many packets are going to come in and out of the box that does not contain the primary supervisor.
So the VSS technology, see, I actually thought that you had the switching fabric in the left-hand side. So the supervisor in the left has got the fabric matrix switching module in it, and the one on the right has a fabric matrix switching module. And between them, we connect multiple 10 gig channels, two or more. And that actually connects the switching fabrics together so that you actually forward a non-block, it still becomes a part of the non-blocking switching fabric. So if it comes in on the left and has to go out on the right, it'll traverse the inter-switch fabric connection.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well, if it has to. But if you have, for example, you know, two downstream switches and each one is plugged into both physical chassis, then packets going from, you know, switch A to switch B in that case are going to stay in a single chassis. The links that connect the two VSS chassis together are only used if necessary. Because they would be the limiting factor. You know, you have 700 gigabit backplanes or something on each end, but 20 gig that interconnects.
I mean, Cisco will claim that they can get 1.4 terabytes of aggregate throughput through the chassis, and they couldn't do that. They couldn't make that claim if there was some requirement that every packet, every frame traverses the inner switch link.
Yeah, so now compare that to the VPC, right? So in the VPC design, which is what the Nexus 5000 focuses on, looks to me like a bit of a copy of what Nortel did about 10 years ago, where we had one edge switch and it would have two connections, one going to each of two core switches, and it can send packets over both links actively. So as far as the edge switch is concerned, the two core switches appear to it like one logical chassis, but instead it's actually two physical chassis appearing as two separate devices, but they work at, they know by communicating with each other with an overlay protocol that that destination exists on the other side and therefore can reassemble the packets into the same frame to the other side. And it's like a, it's very different from the VSS. It's, I'm waving my hands here on the virtual whiteboard, Ethan. Leap in anytime.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, whereas VSS takes those two 6500s and turns them into one, logically anyway, turns them into one great big switch, one administrative domain where you don't have HSRP anymore and you've only got one spanning tree root bridge to be thinking about between the two switches and so on. Yep. VPC, you've got two different switches with some dedicated links that they can keep track of each other. You make a virtual port channel domain, and then you can do load balancing and frame forwarding across ether channels shared between two different switches. So for purposes of the ether channel, it looks like one, it's one logical port, one big port. And so they're really two... They're solving two different problems, or I was going to say they're solving two different problems. That isn't exactly right, but they're solving this problem of wasted ports that are blocked due to spanning tree in two different ways. With VSS, you get an added benefit, if you will. I think Ivan would argue maybe it isn't a benefit, but you get an added benefit of having one management domain now that you've reduced this system down to.
And that's the terrifying part to me, and I think Ivan was going in that direction as well with his comments. You know, if you have one control plane, if that one control plane fails, you know, presumably you would fail over to another supervisor that has another control plane, but you've got quite a bit of fate sharing there between those two chassis now.
It's also a more complex software development too. If you've got to bind, you know, you've got four supervisor modules in two physical chassis. You've also then got to say, I've got one control plane on the right and I've got three other control or routing engines or, you know, whoever the master is in that stack. And they've all got to coherently agree. I inherently distrust VSS because the software hasn't sort of proven itself to me in a way, and it seems like a far more complex solution than VPC.
Has Cisco actually released iOS that supports dual soups in each physical chassis of a VSS config? As last I knew, that was not yet supported, although it was on the roadmap.
It's in the newest software.
It is, okay.
Yeah.
With quite a few caveats, though.
Oh, absolutely. It's a new software. Now, before we go there, I would just like to point out one thing that we've missed. Namely, we have to do MAC address learning in bridging. And you never know on which uplink the host or the access layer switch will send. We have to remember that we still have to learn the MAC addresses from the sources of the forwarded frames. And if you have two parts of an ether channel terminated in two different boxes, then only one of the boxes will see the MAC address. But when the return traffic goes back, both boxes have to know where the MAC address is so that they send the traffic directly. It shouldn't go through the other box. So they have to constantly exchange the MAC addresses that they have learned and update both data planes, both switching fabrics concurrently.
Yeah, and so Cisco's developed some proprietary protocol. Well, not proprietary, because it's only ever going to be between two devices, but it's called the... That's why SplitBrain in the... SplitBrain is the name that Cisco gives to it, the 6500s, when... if, for example, they stop sending hello packets to each other, they'll both go active. And Cisco recommends that not only do you put multiple 10-gig lines between it, you also put another 1-gig line off another line card that provides a heartbeat so that nothing goes... So it always knows when it goes split. But it does seem a very hairy technology.
And what's kind of interesting, though, is it's very similar to the stack technology, the 3750s or, I guess, now 2960s. And I don't know about you guys, but I actually trust that one pretty well, so... Maybe it's because the stakes are smaller, you know, wiring closets versus data centers.
I don't love the 3750 stacks. We've had issues with them. It hasn't been split brain so much as problems where Cisco will tell you that a problem on one switch isn't supposed to affect anybody else in the stack. We found that to not be the case all the time. I've also had problems with stack ports failing on a number of the 3750 Gs particularly, where we had a a data center environment. You're going, why did you put 3750 Gs in a data center? That's another conversation. But they were it was a top of rack solution, 3750 G stacks in the data center. And I hate the friggin' things because of some of the things they did to me. Maybe they've sorted it all out and everything's all wonderful now, but I don't love them. And for similar reasons, I am kind of looking cross-eyed at VSS going, do I want to try this? You know, we brought up some VSS soups in a lab environment and had, I would say, mixed success. You know, you follow the way the book says to build it. You get your inner switch link built between the two and so on, and then have challenges with the failover not behaving like it's supposed to, and other unexpected things happen, crashes, and where a soup engine will crash and just keep going. And that could have been code revision at that time, and we did finally get it to a point where it was stable, but... You know, certainly first exposure to VSS was not a positive one. And I was kind of wondering if any of you guys had managed to roll out a VSS in production or at least some sort of extended test where it had won your confidence, where you were happy with what you were seeing and it seemed to be something that made sense.
Yeah, so Ethan, my story is similar to yours. We actually implemented VSS on a pair of production data center devices after doing it in the lab. And, you know, fortunately in the lab, we didn't test every condition that we had in the data center. And when we put it in the data center, if I recall correctly, most, if not all the ports on the secondary chassis, I'll call it, were unusable. So we ended up actually breaking the VSS and kind of deconfiguring it and making them autonomous switches, and kind of never revisited because,
so left right the VSS that. Soups in there, but just disabled the VSS functionality and used them as just big 720s, basically.
Exactly. A pair of independent Soup 720, Catalyst 6500s. And then, you know, shortly after, we started moving on to buy Nexus gear and kind of never looked back. So,
Now, we've deployed it in one of our data centers. You know, we did some of the testing beforehand, and in the production, it's still in production. It's been there probably 6 months now. And we've not had any issues with it at all. Now, maybe that's unique to, because it's a little bit smaller data center, and pretty much everything it's connected to is another stacking technology, the VBS for their blade switches. So it may have something to do with that, but we've not had any issues in production with ours.
Has it been stable, Steve? Have you had stable? I mean, in other words, have you had a situation where the VSS has needed to fail over to the other soup?
We have not, other than when we first put it in, we kind of simulated some of that during a maintenance window. But in production, we've not had any hardware failures to cause that. And we had actually had in that data center all three AC units failed, and it got nice and toasty. But they kept on going, and everything. All the servers had problems, but the VSS and kept going just fine.
Well, the reason I asked that question is sometimes it's. It's one of those deals where you set it up, you configure, you even test it a little bit, and everything seems great. And then you have an actual failover scenario, and things don't go like they were supposed to go, and you look back and go, oh, I should have done this, or maybe we could have designed this a little differently because the failover didn't work quite like Cisco advertised it. And so I was kind of curious if your VSS unexpectedly broke on you and how successful the failover process was.
No, fortunately, every break has been expected. So I'll have to get back to you when we have one of the supervisors fail unexpectedly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that.
Ethan, just one thing I'd say on what you were saying earlier about the 3750s and comparing it. The 3750 Gs, by the way, yes, absolutely have a whole bunch of stack problems. I have exactly the same issue where Gs die all over the place, and the more modern ones don't. I think the good thing with this is you sort of you're removing that physicals of the stacking cables away from it all, and at least we're kind of while the whole sort of where you put your brain thing is you're still sort of moving your control plane from your data plane, but at least you're using sensible established technology for the actual bit of string that goes between two boxes.
Yeah, you're talking about using the 10 gig interfaces on the VSS as opposed to using the proprietary stack wise cables. That look like kind of like an old scuzzy external connector from back.
Exactly. Because those things, especially on the Gs for some reason, definitely have that there's physicals problem there as well as the sort of the actual stacking concept and split brains and what have you.
Okay, and the other thing to note about VPC technology is that Nortel and other manufacturers, I know Nortel calls it their multi-chassis ether channel, MCEC. I know that Avaya and Force 10 and Arista and all those people have a similar technology. Nobody's doing the combined control plane thing that the VSS is doing. Everybody's gone for the autonomous systems. And I wonder if that... I mean, I had one experience with the VSS in the very early days. I was deploying a new data center and I bought the VSS capable modules, put them in, and I know it was very early, but we had 6 months of testing before they went live. And in fact, as soon as we put the switches into the network and turned them on, the VSS code tried to communicate with all the 6500s and took our entire data center down for 6 minutes while I furiously shut things down. It literally is.
Fantastic.
I booted up two chassis. They weren't configured with anything except a couple of IP addresses. And as soon as I configured the interfaces, all the 6500s directly adjacent to them shut out and rebooted.
Resistance is futile. You will be assimilated.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what my boss said just after in the blame-storming session immediately thereafter. You know, they really had the blame throwers out because I said, no, it'll be fine. You just turn them on. They work fine. And they didn't work fine. So that wasn't a good day. Not one of my better days. There is a big difference between VSS and VPC, but what about, has anybody here looked at the 4500 and what its technology is like? I read somewhere the other day that the 4500 has a VSS capability as well. Has anybody looked at that?
Oh, Lord, say it isn't so. No, I hadn't read that.
I don't see how that could happen, but the whole thing with the 4500 is every packet has to come up through the supervisor.
No, there's a fabric engine for the 4500 now, I think. Okay, let's ask a different question. Has anybody on the call actually used a 4500?
I've turned a few off. We used to use them for wiring closets here and there, but not any longer.
I've actually got a bunch in my world right now, but was not aware that there's any sort of VSS functionality out there. And I'm looking on Cisco's site right now, searching frantically for news of a VSS 4500 design.
Only reason I know it is because somebody tweeted about it this week. The thing I find confusing about the 4500 is that there's about 2,454 different supervisor modules, and I can never work out which one's which. Last time I looked, there was a supervisor 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then there's these enhanced ones with 6L, like there's a supervisor 6L-E now.
Yeah, there's the slow ones that everybody has, and then there's the faster ones you can't afford and don't have all the features you want anyway.
Yeah.
It's not really a happy medium.
And the L's are the layer 2 only supervisors for just probably basic layer 3. So those are more limited.
Yeah.
Do they still insist on numbering them with Roman numerals? I haven't paid any attention lately.
Some of them, but I think the 6, they've gone to an actual 6. So okay. They just do that to confuse you.
And the other problem I've had with the 4500 supervisors is trying to get architectural information on how they're built and what performance they are and what they do. And there's an absolute vacuum. From what I understand of the 4500, Cisco's chopped up into different business units. And there's the enterprise business unit, which makes a 6500 and builds it and the net. Or this is the way it used to be anyway, and targets the enterprise market with that product. But there's another business unit called the SMB that makes the 2900 switches, for example, and the low-end routers. But there's some intermediate division that builds the 4500 that's targeted into a... And they have a different marketing team and different technical engineers and different sales engineers and a completely different way of producing their documentation. I haven't been able to get to the bottom of what the supervisors look like. See, on the website here, it talks about the supervisor engine 2 plus TS, 2 plus, 2 plus gig E, 10 gig E, supervisor 4, 5, 5, 10 gig E, 6 E, and 6 LE. And I know there's also been an 8 and a 9, and I know that the backplane in the 4500 has gone from multiple revisions. I think there's been 3 or 4 backplane revisions as well.
When you buy a new 4500 now, you're probably going to be buying an e-chassis that, with the correct cards in it, I think gives you, I want to say, 64 gig a slot. Is that right? I don't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, but when they do that, they actually obsolete the old line cards as well in some cases. So
in some cases, typically you can still run the classic, what they would call a classic card in the newer chassis, but I don't know that that's always the case.
hasn't been for all of the supervisor engines. Some supervisor engines used a backplane technology which required certain line cards. And I found the trying to work that out too confusing, so I just went back to the 6500. Does anybody use it in the data center? Is there any reason why we wouldn't use it in the data center?
Performance.
Yeah, typically it's a packet forwarding kind of an issue. Functionality, maybe. Some of the soup engines in a 4500 don't offer things like NetFlow, for instance, unless you look for the right soup engine and make sure that it's there. But, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I think of the 4500 as really a big closet switch. Maybe you want to do a lot of PoE in one chassis, that kind of thing, and that's really where I think of it.
Yeah, it's heavily oversubscribed, which you don't want that in a data center, but to your end users, sure, give them 4-to-1, 8-to-1, whatever.
For the listeners, oversubscription means that you might have a 48-port or a 24-port switching module, gigabit switching module, which means you've got a total output of about 24 or 48 gigabits, but the actual connection into the backplane might only be 6 gigabits or 12 gigabits or something like that. And that means, theoretically, you can put more traffic in than can get off that switch. And that is the difference between an expensive switch and a cheap switch, is that the bigger switches have more backplane and can handle peak loads much better.
I think the newer 4500s, Greg, the contention's actually got a lot better on them. I think they now have a 24 gig backplane on them. Which you can, so even if you're putting a 48-port gigabit line card in, that's only 2-to-1, which, and unless you're doing crazy stuff, isn't actually that bad, especially in for low-end data center, or even better for wiring closet stuff. It's excellent oversubscription for a wiring closet.
Yeah, I said 64 earlier, and I think you're absolutely right, Dan. I think 24 is the number. I think it's before 20, the earlier
one. It used to be like, 6 on the old ones, it's 24 on the E's now, which is... when you buy them with the... I think it's the LE card, this Layer 2 only card, they're actually very cheap. The actual sort of cost per port is pretty competitive against against the smaller stack switches. And it is obvious that you have got the different business units fighting over business here, because in reality, there's no kind of business case for Cisco to have this switch. You've perfectly good stackable devices and smaller devices for wiring closets. You've the 6500 sort of platform, which if they wanted to, they could make a cheap version of for low end data center or again big wiring closets. So why develop two parallel technologies? I don't see the actual benefit to it from Cisco's point of view. And they're clearly getting into a price competition with each other now, which is why you're getting these very cheap options.
To close out the, does 4500 have VSS? I don't think it does, but it has a VSS client where it is intelligently aware of a 6500 VSS a pair that it may be uplinked to. But that's the only thing I can find on Cisco's site that that's talking about. I haven't seen anything that indicates a couple of soup engines with VSS, so I've got to find out who was tweeting that and see what they were getting at. But
maybe it's something coming in the future. Could be. I mean, the technology should translate into the 4500 at some point. I take Dan's point as well. Keep in mind that Cisco manufactures the silicon for these things, and there used to be the 6500 used to be several times the price of a 4500, but the actual price differential between the two has narrowed a lot recently, and I agree with Dan to some extent in that it's a little confusing as to why that product exists, but I also think it plays in a marketplace where, maybe the people who are on the podcast, we don't look at that sort of product and don't conceive of it. But if you had a data center with, say, 200 servers in it, spread around a dozen racks, then maybe the 4500 could work for you if you only had very light loads. It's a possibility.
Going back to, it almost sounds like everyone's had some experience with VSS that's been, at best neutral. I guess, Steve, you said you were okay with it. But, I mean, would everybody rather be going the VPC direction?
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely.
I think the reason we put the VSS in versus the full upgrade to the Nexus for this particular data center was we didn't need the 10 gig density. We were trying to get a little bit more speed, but we didn't need that, the entire data center to be 10 gig. So it was more of a, fill in just fill the gap by these supervisors, get the benefits of removing all the spanning tree whilst having still some 10 gig for the servers that need it, but fairly cheap upgrade, where if we were to replace everything to Nexus, it would not have been cheap.
Ivan, you were going to say something there.
Well, not really.
Well, I mean, you were going to say you'd rather have VPC than VSS, and I wanted to hear you go down that road. Why? Because you sound pretty adamant about that you were VPC much preferred over VSS. Why you strongly feel that way?
Well, the only reason I prefer VPC over VSS is that the boxes stay loosely coupled. So if something does go wrong, or even if they go into split brain active, it's not that bad as if you have, if you should have one supervisor, but all of a sudden you have two.
So you would rather keep the administrative domain split as far as layer three redundancy. You're rather be in the HSRP or VRRP world, something like that, and so on.
Yes. Yeah. Personally, but I'm a layer three guy from the ivory tower.
Well, this is a great point to introduce our sponsor for the show, Ascolta Training. Ascolta Training is an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States who offers an array of Cisco advanced courses addressing multiple technologies. Using authorized Cisco course material with strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and consistently have the highest customer satisfaction ratings. Ascolta provides their training using various delivery methods to easily meet your unique needs across the United States, and in addition to their extensive public class schedule, Ascolta excels at developing and delivering client-specific and customized training to fit your environment. And since they're partners for Cisco course development with well-known and industry-experienced instructors, they deliver public training courses and private on-site training. Ascolta has a training solution for you. Please go out there and help them to support the packet pushers. Reach them on 1-800-297-4294 or find them on the web at www.ascolta.com. They're on Twitter as @Ascolta, who you should follow for technical content and for special offers. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class, and you'll receive a $250 discount to get you started. That's Ascolta Training, and they want you to learn something. There's one other weird switch technology which we should probably talk about, and that's the NX2000, which is these flex switches that Cisco's talking about, where they are fabric extenders, FEX, where off the Nexus 5000, and the technology is going to be extended into the 7000 at some point in the future, where instead of actually creating another switch, which has another control plane, which loads all the data into it, what they're doing with the FEX 2000 is actually running the normal, waving my hands here, a virtual whiteboard, put your imagination cap on, people. But you have a Nexus 5000, and then you want to be able to add more ports to the Nexus 5000. So what you do is you create two 10 gig downlinks that goes down to a thing called a FEX 2000, Fabric Extender Nexus 2000. And the Nexus 2000 is a switching fabric in its own right, but routes all the packets back up to the 5000 for handling at layer 3. And what they're not actually Ethernet connections between the switches, although they are, they're more like a VSS interconnect. Has anybody on the call used the FEX modules, or am I on the wrong track?
That's a good description of it. We've got dozens of them in production, and we do a 40 gig downlink to a 48 port 1 gig FEX fabric extender.
40 gig is in 10 4 times 10, not a 40 gig.
Correct. Yeah. 4 times 10. So 4 individual cables at 10 gigs a piece down to this fabric extender. And as you said, it's Ethernet, but it's not. It truly is Ethernet. In fact, there's a tech note somewhere out there that says, don't mark anything else with COS 7, Class of Service 7, because that's what the FEX uses for its control traffic back to the 5000. And if you overrun those queues, you're in some trouble. So,
what I like to think about it, the way I like to look at it is, it's like a remote line card. So instead of having a physical line card in your Nexus, you are having another switching fabric which sits somewhere else and has uplinks to the Nexus. And Jeremy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the ports on the extender appear as virtual ports in the configuration of the Nexus. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. So you plug in a number of FEX boxes, we'll say, and each one is considered a line card in the 5000. So if you plug it into a couple ports and call that port channel 100 to your FEX, the interfaces attached to it would be 100/1, 100/2, up to 100/48 in the case of a 48 port 1 gig card. And if you plug the second FEX into that 5000 and put it into a different port channel, port channel 101, then all of the ports associated with that line card or with that FEX would be numbered appropriately.
You can hang as many as 12 FEXs off of a 5000, is that right?
In the latest code, I think it's 12. I think the code I'm running is 8, but I'm not exactly sure. We never hit that limit, so.
Mm. Yeah, and the way they work, if I'm not mistaken, because I was studying the UCS case, not the exactly FEX case, they use something called VN tag, which is a 6-byte tag that goes somewhere into the Ethernet packet. And it sort of augments the VLAN tags that we're using today. In UCS, the VN tag would be associated with a virtual machine, but here with the port extender, it's associated with a port on the port extender.
Yeah, that's the VN link technology, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. VN link is the name of it, and then VN tag is the actual tag that goes in the thing. Oh, there's so much of this stuff, my head bursts sometimes, I tell you. So there are some weird options there. The FEX module is slated to come. I've heard whispers that it's slated to come to the Nexus 7000 platform later this year, and they're going to extend that technology off that at some point.
Do they switch traffic locally, or do they send all the traffic back to the 5000 and then down on the same link to the other port?
Yeah. All traffic goes to the 5000. So if you have a server plugged into port 1 of a FEX and port 2 of that same FEX, the traffic between those two servers must go up to the 5000 and back down. It's not that big of a deal when you look at the oversubscription. You know, if you use all four uplinks, you know, you have 40 gig of uplink bandwidth for a total of 48 1 gig ports. So 40 gig for 48 ports is, you know, just barely over 1-to-1 oversubscription if you were fully utilizing all those ports. It probably gets a little more interesting if you don't use quite so many uplinks. And if you're looking at the 10 gig FEXs, which give you 32 10 gig ports at the FEX level and have up to 8 10 gig uplinks, you know, so the oversubscription gets a little worse. But I think for practical purposes, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and it does add a bit of latency because you are switching three times instead of once.
Sure.
It doesn't matter so much in modern data centers because we're often switching it inside the VMware server as well.
Yet again, it depends on how you implement that. If you use the vSwitch, you are absolutely correct. But if you decide to go the Cisco's way and use VNTAC, then it goes from the server to the concentrator on top of UCS chassis to the 6100 and then all the way back.
For those platforms, it does. But for those of you who are just using the distributed vSwitch, it's switched inside the VMware before the Nexus, compared to the Nexus 1000 switching module, which honors the original intention of the network, which is you don't switch locally at all. Everything gets switched in the core. Although, no doubt there's somebody out there who knows more about the Nexus 1000. He'll tell us something different.
Yeah, I think it does local switching, but that's just my persuasion.
I want to move the discussion onto the 6500, and it's been the staple of our data center networks for the past, at least for 10 years. Are there situations where the 6500 doesn't cut it? So the 6500 itself has a backplane capacity of, in the latest generations, of 720 gigabits per second. And that basically works out to 40 gigabits per slot in simplex, in one direction. So it's 40 gigabits each way, so nominally it's 80 if you add them both together in a stunning piece of marketing math. Now, if with the advent of 10 gigabits per second, the 6500 is only able to deliver 40 gigs per slot, and even then it's 2x2. Each slot in a 6500 has two 20 gigabit per second switching fabric CPUs that downlink the capacity. So it's not one 40 gig pipe going down the back, it's two 20s. So the line cards themselves actually have to share the two 20 gigabit per channel, each 20 gig channel onto the backplane. Jeremy, you've talked a bit about some data center designs. Where does the 6500 not cut it in a modern network.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It works fine for infrastructure 10 gig. So if you want to uplink that 6500 via 10 gig to, you know, some sort of 10 gig aggregation device, maybe a Nexus 7000 or a kind of a dedicated 6500 with a lot of 10 gig ports. But I don't see it working in a data center that has a lot of 10 gig access layer ports. Just the oversubscription is kind of much too high. You know, the highest density, the oversubscription is pretty high. Plus the port density is very low. You know, if you needed,
you can get 4 gig, you can get 4 port 10 gig line cards.
Right. You can, if you're willing to oversubscribe at the line card level, you can get a 16 port card. You know, but even there, you know, if you put eight cards worth of 16 port 10 gig cards, you're only talking 100 and what's that? Somebody check my math, like 148 ports or something like that.
It's not very many.
And that just doesn't cut it when you could buy a, you know, and that's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars when you can buy a 5020 Nexus for 40 grand list, I think, and that gives you 40 ports. So.
Yeah, plus there's support concerns, plus there's power concerns. The 10 gig cards, the 6500 are real power hogs, plus they throw a ton of heat. Those X2 modules are beastly, as are the cards themselves, heat-wise. So it's not a very efficient footprint for the port density you get, that's for sure. Let alone being subscribed at 4-to-1 if you do that fully populated deal.
The 6500 is a great for two particular things. So one is if you're working at a gigabit level. For gigabit, I mean, as we said, it's a 40 gig backplane, 48 port cards, gigabit card in it. And, you know, you're not far off 1-to-1. You're near enough, as long as you're not doing anything crazy with them, that it's going to work and work well. The other very useful thing, of course, about the 6500, which still makes it stand out in the data center, is the ability to use the multifunction cards in there, so things like the ASA card and the ACE card and all these kind of things, which sort of give you very fast processing firewall functions and for load balancing functions. That's something that's still pretty unique to that platform and certainly has its uses. But you're right, once you get into the 10 gig stuff, I see they're apparently imminently bringing out a new SUP 2T, I think it is, which is going to upgrade the backplane to 80 gig per slot, which then is going to kind of give you, you know, you're back to the sort of eight times 10 gig connections, which is the same as you get in a Nexus 7K. You're starting to get a little bit more like it. And the one thing with the power, they use a lot of power, but compared to a 7K, they're hardly plugged in.
Well, the 7K is a beast, but I mean, compared to a 5K as far as port density.
Yeah,
but true, I mean, true. Yeah, you look at the power budget you have to plug in a 10 gig card in the 6500, and you're like, wow, it's several hundred watts. You're into the 400 and 500 watt range for the big 10 gig cards now.
And just to be clear again, it's not a direct comparison to the 5K because the 5K does not do layer 3.
Right. Oh,
thank you, Jeremy.
Layer 3, who needs that? We don't do layer 3 anymore, do we?
I think we're done with that, right? One flat network.
Well, that's what all the vendors would tell you. Now, one other challenge on 6500, which we've often flailed away at, and I know is one of Ivan's favorite topics, is QoS. So, Ivan, QoS on the 6500 is... full of fun. Tell us about your experiences there.
With what, quality of service?
Yeah.
I'm not a quality of service guy. I'm a routing guy.
I think the key thing is that every single card seems to have a different actual QoS architecture on it. So depending on, you know, you can be switching into one card and out of another card, and you kind of have to do different kinds of QoS on each one, which can be a world of fun. And there can actually be incompatibilities where it actually just straight won't do it unless you use certain commands to say, hey, ignore the QoS differences, which can be fun if you don't know about it.
Oh, Dan, thank you for reminding me. That was the blog post I wanted to write. 65,000 is like an IBM mainframe. It's full of legacy.
Yeah. It really is. And that's good in a way, because at least it's something that's, you know, it's the devil, you know. It's, it has its problems, but we've kind of, you know, if you've been around a while, you've kind of seen all those problems and, you know it. And whereas Nexus, Nexi, whatever you call multiple Nexuses, that's a whole new thing. That's a whole new bunch of weirdness coming down the line there.
I was going to say, without a doubt, Dan, it's its own beast, the Nexus, and I'm with you. I learned all the catalyst side, so Now it's a matter of trying to translate that to how the Nexus works.
Yeah, that's a challenge.
Steve, what about you? Have you had much to do with the QoS on the 6500? Do you feel it's up to snuff?
It's really just a nightmare to try to figure everything out. I mean, because you have so many cards, and then you, as Dan mentioned, and then you say you slap a 7600 blade in there for the SIP SPOC modules, and everything is just different every way. It's such a pain to figure out. It's almost not even worth it. In some cases, it seems, to figure it out.
Just add more bandwidth.
Yeah, exactly.
And the problem is every time you want to turn on some new functionality, it works completely different on each line card. And then after a while, you give up, you call tech, and they type in three hidden MLS something yes. commands, and then it works.
Yeah. Oh, you guys are building a case for standardizing your line cards across your 6500s, though, which is one of the things that we were able to do. One of the places I worked where we had a batch of 6500s that we were buying for a couple of different data centers, and we said when we buy them, they are all going to have line card X. They were the 6748 GETX cards, and we just made sure every 6500 had exactly the same line card where we needed that line card, you know, a 48 port 10100 1000 card, so that when we were writing code, we could standardize on it. It was going to be the same from chassis to chassis to chassis, because when you mix and match, then you run into all those challenges and weirdness and unpredictability and how your code's going to look.
Standardization is your friend. It's the golden rule.
I just want to come back to a point you made earlier about the service modules, Dan. Both the FWSM and the ASA and the IDSM, which are the three service modules that are available. All of those modules
Is ASM still available? I think they took that out and shot it, didn't they?
Well, there's a few of them now. The FWSM is a really odd thing in that it has this way of having a single MAC address in the entire module. So regardless of how many interfaces...
Yes, there's a world of fun with that. There's lots of caveats to using that, especially when you go multi-context.
Yes, and then not only when you go to multi-context, it actually has three network processor layers where firewall rules can be forwarded if it's a certain type of rule, but if it's an inspection rule, it gets bumped up to a network processor, and if it's an application inspection rule, it gets bumped up to a CPU. And you can actually find its performance is less than an ASA. I've come to the conclusion that the FWSM is not worth using. There's a specific use case that you can use it for, and that's where it enables a cut-through firewall mode with the supervisors, and it'll give you a 40 gigabit per second firewall in chassis. But that is a rather unique use case, and if you know why you want one of those, you'll know why you want one. But otherwise, I'd be using an ASA 5580, which is the 10 gigabit, because it gives you far better performance and bang for buck than an FWSM. The ACE module...
It does. The FWSM is old, though, you have to bear in mind. It's not... I mean, if it hasn't been taken out and shot... I'm a little bit out of the current thing on these now. If it hasn't been taken out and shot yet, it's about to be. It's a very old module. It's been around a long time. I'm actually amazed how long that tin's been in place.
Well, they're very popular in service provider environments because you often can't get someone to go out in the field and fit a piece of equipment is very difficult, but to get them to go out and put a firewall module in an existing 6500 is very easy.
Absolutely, okay. It's a card, you know. It keeps things very, very simple, and you've got all the sort of the power controls and that kind of thing built into it, and you've got things like, you know, you have actually still got pretty good connectivity. I say, except the fact that the FWSM itself is kind of old, and the IDSM is the same thing. I think the IDSM is going to be taken out and shot entirely.
Same thing. They've gone with an external unit for that as well.
Yeah, exactly. But I believe there's a new blade which is coming out, which is going to be the new ACE blade and the new ASAM, you know, the ASA module. I think it's going to be the same bit of tin, and you just change the code on it. And this is now going to be sort of fully fabric enabled, work at 40 gig, you know, have all the kind of modern performance things that you would expect. But you know, you are actually now, the great thing is you're connecting directly into the fabric at this, yeah, you know, at 40 gig, as opposed to having to, you know, connect in via a line card into your, sorry, you know, connect in via an interface into your line card into the fabric. So from a performance point of view, it, you know, the new blades will actually make that a lot better.
Yeah, I was going to say with the 6500 and the service modules, I've never seen the cost benefit tip in the direction of having a service module. And I guess mostly because the expense of SmartNet, you know, Cisco SmartNet maintenance on the chassis plus the service module is always, you know, a large factor greater than the individual components. So, you know, when I'm, especially now that I'm building out Nexus-based data centers versus Catalyst-based, you know, I basically would be keeping a 6500 around just to house and power these modules. I don't know if that's been anybody else's experience or...
In the scenario where you're keeping the 6500 just for that, it isn't worth it, money-wise. I think it's more for the sort of the mid-size customer who doesn't really want to have too many bits of tin, doesn't want to use up too much shelf space, is going to have a pair of chassis switches maybe as the core anyway, and you know, well, while you're doing that, hey, let's put the blades in here, let's not have too many extra boxes, but what. Once you start getting bigger and start getting into the sort of scenarios where you're taking multiple racks for, you know, networking anyway within the data center, then yes, you're absolutely right that it becomes less of a business case. I think the logic is that for people who want to have one box that does it all, you know, this kind of gives you that.
Yeah, I had that epiphany once and ran it by my SE, my Cisco SE, that is, to put my, you know, ISP router and my firewall and everything into a 6500 chassis and kind of be done with it in one nice box. And he said, well, you know, what do you do when you got to reboot one component of it or a component of it? And, you know, everything's really powered by the same box. So he talked me out of it, which I think in retrospect, I'm glad he did. So
yeah, you have two of them.
That's a good point. Well, I only have one ISP circuit.
Yeah. I've used the virtualization feature of the ACE modules to great effect. The ability to have one load balancer, or you know, one ACE module carved up into 100 virtual load balancers, gives you certain capabilities. Unfortunately, the ACE module software let me down later on. I found the software fine at the TCP layer, but as soon as you tried to do DNS load balancing or HTTP load balancing, I couldn't rely on the ACE module to work for more than about 40 days at a time before I'd have to reboot them, which wasn't very excellent, and in the end we threw them away.
The early versions of the Ace blade were very, very buggy creatures. I believe they got a lot better as they settled in. Like with a lot of these things, you know. I remember sort of looking at it once, and I think it was the version, it was the first bit of software, version 3 or something like that, and it was 3.001A or something. And you just think, yeah, this is good to put my live network onto.
Yeah, it was actually called 1A, and then it got called 302A, and then they started calling it 3.0. And then they started calling it 2, 2.1, 2.2. I was like, what? How's that work? The numbering system was really weird. And you went from version 301 to version 2, but version 2 was later than version 3. I gave up on the ACE modules. I won't buy them anymore because the software let me down. One of the things that Jeremy raised in the show notes was that talking about the proliferation of 10 gigabit attached user devices pushing the need for higher density. Jeremy, why don't you lead us out on what your thrust is with that point?
Yeah, I can go over my story. So last year, or actually about a year and a half ago, we started planning to build a new data center. And, you know, I thought this was the time to put 10 gig in, and went to my data center teams and server teams and said, you know, what do you need for 10 gig? You know, we're ready to go. And I think they totaled up to a grand total, maybe 12 or 15 ports. You know, they just didn't have the interest at the time, even for the SAN head end gear. They just didn't have the interest. So we built that data center. It's Nexus based, and it's, you know, the FEXs, and I've described it a bit here, a few thousand ports. Well, it turns out this coming year we're building another new data center, and I went back around and did the same exercise, and the total I got was about 750 10 gig ports. So, you know, 18 months later, and the demand is just astronomical. So I kind of wonder why. A lot of those ports are either SAN related or HP. We use a lot of HP C-class chassis. They want to do a lot of 10 gig out of those chassis. And, you know, there's dozens and dozens of chassis that are going to be bought for this new project. So
when you say SAN related, are you talking NAS heads for something presenting SIFS or NFS? Or are you talking like FCOE?
No, SIFS, NFS, iSCSI, even not FCOE. We have Actually, I got some meetings next week where I'm going to lobby very hard to not put any fiber channel in the new data center. We'll see if I get my way. But
that's a good decision, Jeremy.
Oh, I really hope I win. So.
Okay, everybody. Well, thank you very much. And that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us again this week. Ivan, thanks very much for coming on the show. Tell us about yourself and what you're going to be doing.
So the next few days, I'll be finishing the material for the data center webcast. Then I have a few consulting jobs, and then we'll probably meet in San Jose.
And where can people find you?
blog.ioshints.info is a great starting point. Or if you really want to listen to my ramblings on Twitter, it's at ioshints.
And don't forget that Ivan and myself will be in San Jose doing data center designs. I encourage you to come along and talk to us about designing your own data center. Of course, I'd like to thank Dan Hughes for coming in this week. I'm so glad you could make it. I know you weren't here at the beginning, but tell us what you're doing this week, Dan.
I'm basically trying to turn up some data center capacity right now, so that's keeping me pretty busy. But you can, if I get any brief interludes in it, I will be blogging on blog.aloran.co.uk, or you can follow me on Twitter at @rovingengineer.
Thank you, Dan. And Steve Rosen, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us what you're doing this week.
Well, this week I'm finishing up. We mentioned the Zigo. We're doing a demo, and we're wrapping that up this week. And if you'd like to follow me, the easiest way to do that is on Twitter, just simple @Steve. It's the best way to do it.
Hey, thanks a lot. Ethan?
Hey, I'll be finishing up a 6500 build. And you know, I got such a long list of old equipment to be replacing with new that I'm starting to actually lose track of it until someone pings me and goes, hey, when are we going to have this installed? And I go, oh, yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks, or I'll blog at packetattack.word.com and a bunch of other places. But if you go to Packet Attack, I got links to all the other places because I can't seem to stop writing. It is an addiction.
I do have one anecdote to tell you, Ethan, that you'll enjoy, is that I was chatting to one of our engineers today. We were reviewing a part of a design, and there was a switch in the core of our network which hasn't been rebooted for 5.5 years.
Beautiful.
Don't touch it.
Yes, that was the fear. It's a router.
Yeah, somebody came to me yesterday. He brought me a Snickers bar because he was worried that my diva level was going to go very high. He was recabling something in a rack, accidentally knocked the power out of a switch and plugged it back in, and it was done. So he was bringing me the Snickers bar by way of apology for killing the switch. This thing is a 2900XL that's so old. I mean, it's got the letters worn off the front. That's how long the thing's been around. I was actually glad.
I haven't seen a 2900XL in a long time.
Oh, it's an old ILO switch.
There you go.
That's now dead.
Yeah. And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter at etherealmind. We'd love to hear your feedback about the show, so please send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. We do answer, we do reply, and we do want to hear what you're thinking. You can also check out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net to leave comments on the show. Or follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.